Hello, my friends. Peter Fleming here. And as I record this, I very much hope you're enjoying the festive season. Now, as you may have noticed, the hunt for my lost programmes has taken somewhat of a back seat this year, as throughout 2023, I was travelling the country with a special live talk, Peter Fleming Meets Doctor Who, celebrating 60 years of the nation's second favourite time traveller. Who's the first, you ask? Don't make me laugh. And so, to make up for the absence of Into the Archives this year, I thought I'd share an off-air recording, as it were, of that show with you today. Now, this was recorded at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, and it isn't perfect. The final third was slightly reordered down the line, for one thing, and the show is highly disrespectful to the Colin Baker and Peter Capaldi eras, for another. And to William Hartnell and Patrick Troughton personally, if you want a third. But the atmosphere was good in any case, so I'm sure you'll enjoy it. You know, people were having so much fun, they started imagining it was a comedy show and that I'm a fictional character. And I have to confess, it was so infectious, I started believing the same for a little while. But I'm much better now. There are, of course, one or two drawbacks to this format. The show had quite a few visual elements that you'll sadly be unable to appreciate without telesnaps or linking narration from Fraser Hines. You can't see me read out the disclaimer from BBC video releases of the 1990s at the very beginning, or hold up the logo when the appropriate music is played. You can't see my fabulous homemade Tom Baker scarf and my enormous brown coat giving way within minutes to a Pertwee-esque plum jacket. You can't see my stunningly accurate rendition of a regeneration, aided by a shoot of red tissue paper on each hand and a slightly wider one over my head. You also can't see the various illustrative photographs I hold up of key players of the classic era. All the Doctors, Daleks and Thals, K-9, John Noakes and Shep, Mary Whitehouse with a Hitler moustache scribbled on her face. And speaking of faces, you can't see mine either, as I act out various pictures to BBC bigwigs over the years. The freezing with nerves, the slight dip of my eyeline as I notice I haven't spoken for 10 seconds, the horror as it occurs to me I've forgotten how to speak at all, and the slow sinking realization that it's happened again, and, just like before, this meeting isn't going to go very well. And last of all, of course, you can't see the image of a rather awkward little boy dressed in a stripy shirt, a psychedelic waistcoat, and a pair of baggy beige shorts, his arms rigid at his side and his hands pressed firmly over his pockets for some reason. But if you're a fan of Lost television, you're probably used to filling the gaps, so I'm sure it won't matter too much. And I have at least provided that final image with this very edition of Into the Archives, so at least you've got some indication. Next year, the search for my programmes will continue. But for now, let's sit back and once more wish a very happy birthday to Doctor Who. It's Saturday, the 26th of August, mid-afternoon, and in a sweltering room just beneath a youth hostel, your favourite children's TV pioneer, apart from Tony Hart and several others, is about to take to the stage.
Paddy Kingsman, right, there we go. Thank you very much, everybody. The awards are out of the way, all the stress is gone, and here I am, your headliner for this year's Edinburgh Festival. yes, it's lovely to be here. I think this is going to be the most fun I've ever had, because I've finally accepted the fact it's going to be imperfect. It's wonderful, isn't it? You can finally just let go of all the... Sometimes I used to guilt trip myself and think to myself, what if people come along and leave feeling like it's not the best comedy show they've ever seen? I feel so guilty, preemptively. But I've got this wonderful trick about it, work your way around it this way. Early this morning, see, I listened to the album Pink Moon by Nick Drake, and it gave me this wonderful sense of perspective. You see, it's not just comedy, there's loads of things this isn't going to be as good as. So just set the nice and low, trip on the floor. That's the main disclaimer I have to get out of the way. There's just one more that we have to do before we actually begin. That's the standard disclaimer you get from the start of any BBC video of the early to mid-90s, so just bear with me. In the unlikely event of any picture interference, please, in this format, very unlikely, to be honest, get an eye test. Please adjust your video recorder's tracking control. This will, in most cases, rectify both sound and picture quality. The recording, copying, loan, unauthorised hire, public showing, or broadcasting of this BBC Enterprises videogram is prohibited. There we are. And just to show what a fanboy I am, there's nothing written on this, it's just... Right, so now we'll just start the music and hopefully that'll work, and then you can just pretend I'm not here for just a second and we'll start the show properly. So thank you very much. I want to get different coloured ribbons. I couldn't afford them. Just pretend I'm not here. People of Edinburgh, please put your hands together and welcome to the space... Don't look at me. Please put your hands together and welcome to the space-time continuum. He's clearly already materialised in me, Peter Fleming. I'm sure you'll all be familiar with my work, all the children's television programmes I masterminded for the BBC all through the 1960s and 70s, Mrs. Popjoy's Magic Attic, Derek and the Porcelain Matron. Yes, remember, to bed, Richard Boy, or I'll shatter my palm on you! Any days. Well, it's wonderful to be with you. Thank you for joining me here for Peter Fleming meets Doctor Who. Doctor Who is 60 this year, can you believe it? I remember when I turned 60, the fact that Doctor Who is apparently not yearning for death is completely beyond me. But over those 60 years, it's become part of the fabric of what it means to be British. I think all of us feel some stake in it. It says something about who we are as a country, as a people. And as a result, I think whatever our background, whatever walk of life we're on, whatever political persuasion, we feel some sense of ownership over it, feel some stake, some protective instinct about it. I can prove this, actually. On the 19th of November, this happened, 2021, International Men's Day, the Conservative MP, Nick Fletcher, stood up in Parliament and said the following: in recent years, we have seen Doctor Who, Ghostbusters, Luke Skywalker, The Equalizer, all replaced by women. And men are left with the Krays and Tommy Shelby. Is there any wonder we're seeing so many young men committing crime? It's a fair point, isn't it? Protect, though, in this otherwise watertight argument is, before this reversal of the seesaw and all the heroes were played by men, surely crime amongst women and girls should have been through the roof. So I was a bit confused, so I wrote to Nick Fletcher MP on this point, and to his credit he got straight back to me with the following very insightful reply: women don't commit crimes, they're far too pretty. His words, not mine. There's a strange point we've been making there, isn't it? Because of course, anyone who knows Doctor Who's history, well, that's been pushing the boundaries of diversity behind the scenes, for one thing, ever since it began. I mean, the first ever producer of Doctor Who was Verity Lambert, a 27-year-old Jewish woman in her first ever producing job. The first ever director of Doctor Who was Boris Hussain, a 24-year-old gay man who'd been born in India, moved to Britain when he was a child. Now, if you announced a lineup like that behind the scenes today, somebody like Nick Fletcher MP might roll his eyes and say, typical woke BBC. But what's very interesting is back then, he'd have said something far worse. So there's some... I think I've now got two more disclaimers to make. The first one is, sadly, that's pretty much the last reference I'll be making to Doctor Who in the modern era. So apologies to any disappointed Capaldi heads in the room. But my connection with the programme is a lot less close these days, largely due to a well-deserved retirement from the industry, but partly also due to a thoroughly undeserved restraining order. But in spite of what you might think from his work, Stephen Moffat has absolutely no sense of humour. It's a terrible shame. The other disclaimer, obviously, I should make is it's August, it's quite a hot room, I'm not doing the entire show, but it'd be ridiculous doing it dressed as the third, much more sensible. Well, I mean, I say dressed as the third, I mean, this should really be double-breasted, this should be frilly, personally never wore a tie, and this knitting pattern, actually, I mean, Tom Baker never wore a scarf that actually matched this in any way whatsoever. But I always like to put a few deliberate mistakes in to wind up any diehards of or hooligans, as I believe. There's actually also deliberate mistakes. Hooligans is actually a subsection of fandom that rocks up to conventions flipping over all the tables and punching people. They did it the other weekend in Warrington, absolutely wrecked the place. They sprayed an incredibly rude word on Paul McGann. He was very upset. But I'm just talking about Doctor Who in its original run, where between 1963 and 1989, Doctor Who and I crossed paths numerous times at the BBC, seldom to either of our benefits. But I should tell the full story. So join me on my own little time machine as we travel back to 1963. Please Please Me is at number 2 in the charts. The UK is enjoying its final full year in which Nigel Farage doesn't exist. And I was the talk of BBC BBC Television Centre. I was fresh off the heels of the success of my debut series that I made for the children's department, Professor Zany's Mad Laboratory. We'll remember, don't we? Professor? Yes? You've done it again! Scrambledacious! It was very popular for the first week. It was a runaway success, it really was. I was the talk of TV Centre, the cream of the crop. The people in charge wanted to know what I was up to. They were interested in me. I'd walk along the corridors, I'd go past the bigwigs in TV Centre, I'd say, "Good morning, sir." They'd say to me, "Who are you?" They wanted to know. It was astonishing. And I heard on the grapevine, there was a gap in the schedule. The dads were drifting away from the TV just after Grandstand had finished with the football results. Then there was absolutely nothing for 25 minutes. No interest from the audience whatsoever before the teenagers started drifting back on board for Jukebox Jury. They needed something to bring the whole family together. And I heard that the drama department were working on their own committee-devised format. And I thought, it's not really fair to stitch it out like this. There should be some healthy competition. It's best for the viewers this way. So I started devising a format of my own. It was a program. It was going to be a program about an ageless adventurer taking normal, everyday companions with him all through countless adventures across time, through history. I think you know what it was, don't you? Yes. This was the birth of, you guessed it, Clockman the Wizard. I'll explain the format in case there are any Philistines in. But essentially, how it all worked is Clockman was this strange, ageless traveller with all different clothes from all different periods, and he had this little pocket watch, which when wound correctly, would instantly transport him and any children who happened to be making physical contact with him at that point, usually one or two per episode by sheer luck, he would take him anywhere, either into the distant past or the far future, within his native Wiltshire. And it was a practical idea. The idea was we're going to film it all on location in Wiltshire, because the good thing is, it's quite easily portrayed in any time period, because as a county, it's never really advanced. And so it would have been, it might have got the gig, the whole TV landscape, TV history would be very different today. We'd all be here at Clockman instead, were it not for the fact. I had a very rare bout of nerves when it came to pitching the series, as it were. I went to the head of children's department's office with all the ideas for the series. I got in front of her, I looked in the eyes, and I said to her, I was there for 40 minutes. By the end, they were furious, absolutely appalling. So in the end, Clockman, it wasn't going to be Clockman's day, sadly. But I had no hard feelings, because Clockman, of course, had its own breakthrough down the line. It became a success of its own. The viewing figures were on the scale. It was incredible. We all know the catchphrase, don't we? We're all together now. Oh, waggle, waggle, tickety tick. Yeah, you do all that. You do now. You, my friend, you're gonna. I tell you what, my friend, you're gonna sing the theme tune. And it's all, the words will be in your heart. You believe me now. I'll count you in. All right, 2, 3, 4.
Clockman.
That's it.
That's it. Don't ever get it wrong again. Clockman's day, but there were no hard feelings. Doctor Who got the gig in the end. It was all fair play, I think. And it was only in the spirit of friendly rivalry that I spent the next 6 months trying to sabotage Doctor Who before it even got off the ground. And it was trying to undermine it at any opportunity, just kill it dead. And the most effective little bit of trickery I managed to get under my belt was I actually tinkered around with the paperwork when they were allocating it a studio. You see, originally Doctor Who was allocated TC1 in TV Centre. It's the biggest TV studio in Europe in its day. It was state of the art, exactly what they needed. So I crept into the offices in the dead of night, and I scribbled out TC1, and I allocated them Lime Grove Studio D. Yes, there's the fan. It's incredible. Essentially, Lime Grove Studio D, it was a boot camp, completely unsuited to... I'll give you an example. The technology there was so antiquated in Lime Grove that under the hot studio lights, the sprinklers would turn on if you could so much as start an enormous fire in the gallery. Occasion. It's a shame there's no visual record left of it, because actually the fourth episode of The Adventure where they meet Marco Polo, the sets are incredibly singed that week. I really played a blinder that day. So it was a terrible shame, but nothing I could do could actually phase them. I think the Doctor Who team, they knew they all had something to prove. I mentioned Verity Lambert, Boris Hussein, they knew what a big break it was for them. But I think no one knew what a big break it was more than that wonderful character actor of the stage and screen who first played the title role, William Hartnell. There he is. Look at that fellow. There he is. I mean, this is a retirement gift for him, this role. I mean, he'd spent decades in his career being typecast as tough guys and gangsters and sergeant majors who could all remember their lines. And suddenly he was free. Grandfatherly, mercurial, and over the course of 3 years, showing a complete lack of any mental competency whatsoever. I know, bless him, he wasn't well. It's a long time ago, there was. It was just a good laugh, really. But he was absolutely incredible, was William Hartnell, a real retirement gift. And between him and the crew, everyone working on that show, they made Doctor Who into a multi-camera miracle. I mean, it's hard to get across exactly how television was made back in those days. TV drama, there were no computers, there was no time, there was no money. How Doctor Who would be made? The actors would essentially play the scenes out in real time, as live, while the four or five cameras were choreographed around them in this televisual ballet, all choreographed by the director up in the gallery, while the vision mixer next to them would create the visual effects in real time. It's astonishing. Like, you don't make drama. It's certainly not science fiction like that anymore. You know, soap operas, perhaps, and it's still used for sport and Blue Peter and The One Show, but just think about that for a moment. With a setup no more sophisticated than that, the Doctor Who team were able to craft some of the most innovative, spellbinding, immortal moments of television ever to grace the screen. Which begs the question, what's the One Show's excuse? nothing could face them. How did they do it, though? How did they do it? I mean, I think, really, you have to credit them with the ideas. It was a flexible format, Doctor Who, for one thing. I mean, Clockman was all very well in his pocket watch. But is there anything more wonderful and spellbinding than that idea of the TARDIS? An ordinary police telephone box. You step through the doors, bigger on the inside, your gateway to a whole universe to explore, eons of time, countless civilizations to meet. It's an incredible idea. But you have to bear in mind, this is now indelibly linked to Doctor Who itself. You have to put yourself in the mind of a child in 1963, when this was an everyday sight. These were common. They were they could be on any street corner. You have to bear in mind, this was as common a sight as the red telephone box also no longer is. It's an astonishing thing. You know, that's what Doctor Who did. It took the ordinary and made it extraordinary. And I think perhaps the best tool in their arsenal for achieving that was with those wizards of sound at the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. They were pioneers. They created a whole sound world. We walked into a lot of their work as we came in today. It's absolutely astonishing. And there's a funny story about the theme tune, actually, that I came on to. When Ron Grainer, who composed the theme tune, first heard it, he said to Delia Darmstadt's realisation, he said to her, "Did I really write that?" And to be fair to him, if you'd seen the size of his BBC paycheck, you'd be forgiven for thinking he hadn't. But he never did things the easy way, the Radiophonic Workshop. That's what I liked about him. They never really used any instruments. They would always try and they would come up with a sound the long way around. They would work out something difficult and complicated. I worked with them firsthand, so I know what it was like. I mean, some people might remember my 1967 series, The Magic Egg. Do you remember that? But the final episode for the hatching sequence, they created this sound here. I'm sure some of you will remember it. Now, you might think that's just a series of eggshells all being cracked and layered on top of one another. No, not the easy way for the Radiophonic Workshop. What Brian Hodgson, the sound engineer, did is he got a terrier skull and just crushed it in a vice. As you'll hear, actually, if you listen to the full, raw, edited sound recording, here we go. He was a psychopath. But it was with that same sort of approach that they, not with any animal cruelty, but with that same approach that they created the sound of the TARDIS, that wheezing, groaning sound, time and space being ripped asunder. But that particular sound, this one here, now, it's not a cow in labour that a lot of people used to fear. They did try that, but no one could go and make a veil for weeks. That's a nightmare. But this is actually a front door key being scraped up the bass strings of a piano. That's how they did it. And for all of these bleeps, there's a spaceship that passed by, they just hung the microphone out of the room. I mean, you can't have something like that comes along, can you? But with all of those building blocks in place, the stage was set for that first transmission, the 23rd of November, 1963, 5:15. Try and cast your minds back to that. Children all across Britain in their living rooms in front of their television sets at 5:15, as the world was about to change forever.
This is the BBC. It is with deep regret we announce that President Kennedy is dead.
Yes!
We didn't like the man. He was superficial. I'm sorry. But you know what? To be fair, it had a terrible repercussion in the Kennedy assassination. It caused such a huge disruption to Doctor Who's first transmission, enormous distraction. His name was in for all the street parties. It was terrible. Finally, justice for Marilyn. Wonderful. Yeah, it's a slow burner, but eventually... and two gasps. That's about the fewest it's got so far, though. I know it would work best here. But it was incredible. But, I mean, it caused caused such disruption that first week that some people theorised that perhaps the JFK assassination was part of some larger conspiracy originating from the BBC itself to undermine Doctor Who at any opportunity. Now, I wasn't involved before you asked, although I will say, rumours have abounded ever since that the second gunman was actually future BBC One controller, Michael Gray. he's never denied it. I don't think he's in. So, which is why I've said it, you know, you can't... Well, it's not libel, it's slander, I've said it out loud. I know what media law I'm breaking. Don't you worry. It's a terrible shame that it did that, really. But gradually, the excitement died down and the audience has flocked back to Doctor Who. And if there were any doubts as to whether this thing had staying power, then that answer came just a few weeks later. Now, I lived in Hammersmith at the time, and on my walk to TV Centre, I always went past this school, St. Bartholomew's, and I went past it. And one day, normally what I'd hear is children reciting things they'd seen off the television, one kid shouting, waggle, waggle, tick-tock. And I'd reach for the railing and say, it's tickety-tick, you idiot! But one day, I was walking along, and I just got caught from your voices all shouting, exterminate, exterminate, I am the Dalek, you are my prisoner, you will be destroyed. I couldn't believe it. This thing was connecting with children on a scale that I'd never seen, like nothing I'd ever seen before. I realised that, ironically, unlike the Daleks, this show had legs. This is going to run. At least that's what I realised eventually. I mean, at the moment it happened, I thought they'd all gone mad. Called the police, had the whole school arrested. You should have seen my face, I'd explain it. But the Daleks made a huge success out of Doctor Who overnight, just 5 weeks in. And how did they do it? How did they capture children's imaginations? I mean, there's the design, of course, Lehman Cusick, you know, wonderful piece of design work there. And the voice as well. Again, another marvel of the radiophonic workshop. Now, not everyone knows the technique of this, but how did a Dalek voice? They have David Graham and Peter Hawkins, the voice artists, doing the lines. And then Brian Hodgson just ran at them with a cheese grater. And of course, I mean, no, Brian, we didn't want any treatment for this. And he was absolutely unstoppable, shredded them to pieces. That's how David Graham stopped doing it after 66, poor man. But you have to also think about the ideas behind the Daleks. I mean, there are fans nowadays who say, I prefer Doctor Who before it got political, before it tried ramming an agenda down my throat. But I say to them, how do you explain the Daleks in that second ever story, the pit of the Daleks against the Thals? Now, writer Terry Nation was clearly inspired by his memories of the Nazis and the Second World War and their ideology of racial purity. I mean, how else do you explain the story where the TARDIS crew teams up with a race of heroic Aryan farmers to destroy a race of evil wheelchair users on life support? But Dalek mania took over Britain all through 1964, 65. It was astonishing. And it buoyed Doctor Who as well as a programme. There was one episode of Doctor Who, no Daleks even in it. But over 13 million people tuned in one Saturday evening. As a percentage of the UK population, that's 25%. One in four people watched that episode of Doctor Who go out. Unfortunately for Doctor Who, it's the Web Planet episode one, which is awful. But you can't have everything, can you? So it really seemed that Doctor Who was secure. And there was just one vital component left to put into place that was going to ensure its longevity for decades to come. And it's all wrapped up in dear old William Hartnell. I mean, I've hinted before that he was struggling to remember his lines, he wasn't too well. It's a bit of an excuse, to be honest with you. Actually, what happened, why he left the programme in 1966, is he and I had a very minor misunderstanding whereby I accidentally, violently pushed him down a flight of stairs. Now, in my defence, I will say, if you go around a modern building like TV Centre in Edwardian garb, surely it's occupational hazard to be mistaken for a ghost. I thought my hands were straight through and I'm mortified. But they came up with a device to write him out of the programme that was a real stroke of genius, regeneration. The idea that not just the lead actor would change, but the character, the tone, the entire format of the show, Doctor Who could renew itself for whatever times it found itself in for generations. And even regeneration itself has regenerated. And it's changed from what was once practical necessity, a simple question of fading from one actor to the other on the studio floor. And now it's a narrative drive of the programme. The Doctor goes out in a noble blaze of sacrifice or might even rage against the dying of the light, trying to cheat death as best they can. And I can show you actually a quick example of how it's changed now. Now, you know, it's a quick stop to any fans of the new series in there, so I'll do a bit of acting, my best acting, and you can do some of it. And you can get involved as well. You can do a bit of panto wailing at the operative line. I'm sure you'll know it because it was seen by 12 million, so I'm sure that was some of you. So just imagine we're on the TARDIS, you're the camera, and here comes poor old David, and he's I take this off as well, actually, I'm too warm. So here he comes, and then close up, and then I don't want to go. And you remember the crying, not laughter, that's wrong. It's crying, no, don't go, David. Matt Smith will never hold a candle to you. But please don't come back in 14 years or you'll deaden the impact. And then a nation weeps, and then eventually David Tennant just stands there and does this.
What, will someone tell me what the hell is going on here?
And if anyone's not seen Doctor Who, that's what it is. There we are. So William Hartnell was gone, he was out on his ear, but I don't think there were any complaints. I think Doctor Who was in safe hands with that tremendous character actor who inherited the role from him, Patrick Troughton. Look at that. Isn't he marvellous, isn't he? He was wonderful. Now, he was a wonderful character actor, and his characterisation role was described by many as a sort of cosmic hobo. They described it as inspired by Chaplin. I was a bit miffed, personally, because I think it was delineated from my 1966 series, Tramps in Space. I remember, excuse me, sir, do you have any spare change? Over. You remember that? The final episode of the gentry chasing, they burn up in the Amazon. Horrible. Yeah. He was wonderful, Patrick Troughton, but he's a very mysterious figure, I suppose, most of all because so many of his episodes are sadly missing from the BBC archives. I mean, it's not just him, there are William Hartnell episodes that are missing. What would happen is the BBC, to save money, would reuse the videotapes they recorded programmes on. So many recordings, you just can't see them. It happened all over the place. It wasn't just Doctor Who, it was mine as well. There's no more Clockman the Wizard, that's all gone. No more Minnie the Steam-Powered Elephant, or Freddy the Door. There's none of it. Love that one. But the worst thing is you don't see, he was such a visual, physical actor, a wonderful face, and you can't see what he's doing, what tics and mannerisms are crossing that wonderful line, craggy bit. The interesting thing about Troughton's face is a fun fact. The lines on Troughton's face were so deep, there's many makeup artists who actually fell into them and just never seen again. No one knows where Sonia Markham is, but she's got to be in this picture. But the good thing is, all of these Doctor Who episodes that are missing were recorded by fans of the telly. You can still see them, you can hear them in sound form. And I think there's nothing that exercises creativity in fans more than a gap. Doctor Who has gaps in its history. And what fan hasn't listened to those recordings and directed their own multi-camera television programme with their own cast in their head? Fans have gone digging and found off-air photographs and created their own reconstructions. I mean, some people have even created entire comedy characters inspired by missing episodes and created something almost resembling a career. It's just... I mean, it's wonderful. You know, it's a way you get immortality in a way that no other Doctors do. I think it makes that era that little bit more magical. So it's about time somebody said this. Let's have a round of applause for everyone who wiped those episodes. Come on. For them. Just Doctor Who, though, not mine. Someone found an episode of Clockman in Hong Kong once. They watched the film, said it wasn't very good, burned it. I think that makes me the only person who's lost a piece of television twice. I hate it. But he was a wonderful, but you don't get to see much of Troughton. You know, Doctor Who, I think the heart of it is its mystery, and he's probably one of the biggest mysteries of all. Not least because he didn't stick around for all that long. He was gone in 3 years as well, just like Hartnell was. It's a shame. I think the production team wanted to get more out of Troughton. He's a much healthier man than Hartnell, apart from all the problems. But it was a terrible shame. But he had this maxim he always stuck to. Only stay for 3 years. He adopted it with every acting job and wife he ever had. he was gone in 3 years. Actually, there's a fun story. When Peter Davison was playing the Doctor in the 80s, Troughton said to him at the very beginning, only stay for 3 years. Just said that to him in the car park. Poor thing, the sad thing is that Davison had no idea that Troughton would just say that to anybody, whatever the conversational topic. On the off chance, he came across as wise. Stop, clock is right twice. He said it to me once. I was walking past him. I said, hello, Patrick. Hello, Peter. Are you well? Yes, I'm just off on holiday to Italy. Only stay for 3 years. Stay for a week, you maniac. Shame. He was off on his way, but I don't think there were any complaints about Troughton's replacement, that consummate showman, John Pertwee. Yes, he would have been the first one I applauded as well. He was marvellous, John Pertwee, and he was an action man, a Doctor Who, a James Bond type figure. He loved his gadgets and his Venusian martial arts. Do we know Venusian martial arts? How Venusian martial arts works, essentially, you push someone over, And as you push them, you say, hi! And that's the same as martial arts. I mean, but if you say it's Venusian, they can't touch it. It's not culturally inappropriate in any way. That's how you got away with it. And he was a wonderful theater, old John Pertwee. And he loved his martial arts, he loved his gadgets, he loved his cars. And that's actually how he and I first met. Because when he first got the room in 1969, they got in this lovely little car to drive around, Bessie. And funnily enough, I was into cars somewhat myself at this point, and I had an identical sprightly yellow roadster of my own. And it caused a slight mix-up in the car park at TV Centre, because I went down, thought it was mine, got into Bessie, drove her down to South End and pushed her off a pier. You can imagine my fear when I came back and found all the evidence I've been trying to get rid of was still there. I mean, John was absolutely horrified. I mean, he took it to be some kind of threat, understandably, and I was determined to set the record straight. I keep going up to him and say, John, can I expect you? Always sprint off in the other direction. I tried calling him in the canteen. He jumped into a vat of soup, horribly scolded, but he was going to get rid of me. In the end, I started taking walk-on roles in the show, just sneaking in to try and make contact with him. I took roles as monsters as well. And actually, people were surprised. Pertwee was known for comedy. Everyone was surprised he played the role so straight, because he's always fixing the monsters with a steely glint when he's facing them. But that's because he's always worried it's going to turn out to be me again. Claws of Axos, I think it was. He was there. Axos was in a dormant state until I activated it. I'm sorry, John. Hi! His instincts kicked in. It was absolutely appalling. Poor old John Pertwee. He started living as a scarecrow in the end just to get rid of me. He was delighted when Wurzel Gummidge came along, gave him the chance to monetize the lifestyle. But I mean, it was a bold new era for Doctor Who. I mean, this is the first big change of the format that I really enjoyed when Pertwee came along. The series was now in colour, which was a big innovation. Not that everyone realised, all the TV sets in the UK were largely in black and white about 1976. But the production were very clever. They got around it by giving away free tabs of acid in the Radio Times. Left over from the Summer of Love. I mean, really potent stuff. If you thought the mutants was weird already, absolutely weird. I still get flashbacks to episode 4 now. Ah, sorry, there's one. Yeah, I thought, you know what, they're nice. Chuck that one, even though I cut it out 5 months ago because it wasn't very good. But, you know, every now and then. But as well as that, they exiled the Doctor to Earth. Suddenly, it was set in the modern day. The threats were far more pertinent to your viewers. You know, you'd be far more frightened of a Yeti on your loo in Tooting Beck. But the result of that was that it caused Doctor Who to come into a confrontation, its first major confrontation, with the greatest monster it ever faced in all its lifespan, Mary Whitehouse. We all remember Mary Whitehouse. I'll tell you what, if anyone's not familiar with her, she was a campaigner. I suppose the best thing, she's someone whose politics I think you can guess from a photograph. So that's what I would say. There's a fun story behind this, actually. Originally, the joke was going to be, she's someone whose politics you can guess from a photograph. And then I was going to hold up a picture of the real Hitler and say, oh, I'm sorry, I don't know how that got in there. But I didn't want to print that off at work. I just did some scribbling instead. I'll tell you what, here's a slightly more reflective one of her campaigns itself. Children at risk from violent and obscene videos. I will just say, to clarify, she's smiling here so she looks pro. She's not. She's actually very angry. But she was always attempting to stamp out any corrupting influence on young people from culture as she saw it, be it swearing, violence, or religions that weren't her own. She was appalled by all of it and always trying to stamp it out. And she had to go doctor a lot. I remember in 1963-64, she bought the Daleks, Tea Time Terror for Tots. I think there she had to go to the Tomb of the Cybermen as well, where a Cyberman's chest was ripped open. But she was also always having a pop at my programmes as well. Even as early as Professor Zany, she had a go at, there was an episode that had a robotic priest in it, his latest invention. But she didn't like it. But I will say, to my credit, I mean, we don't know how baptisms are going to be done in the future. Maybe they will be done by water cannon. We can't control. But she didn't like it at all. And she confessed she was up in arms about an episode of Clockman the Wizard where a young girl expressed free will. She didn't like that at all. And she started an enormous letter writing campaign in opposition to my 1971 series, Harry the Cunt. What's interesting about that series is actually, it was always about two lovely old ladies who ran a bakery together, but I called it out to see if she and her followers ever actually watched the things they complained about, and sure enough, they didn't. And I was very smug for the first week and then stressed for the next 6 months. She kept writing, there were loads of them. The only way to take the heat off myself was to start pointing at anonymously, tipping her off about everything that was going on with Doctor Who. And that was what drew her to her first big collision in 1971 with the John Pertwee story, Terror of the Autons. And there was a scene where a plastic plastic troll doll comes to life and strangles a man in his living room, and it really caused a big reaction. But that story caused a lot of ruckus as well, with the police as well, because there was the Metropolitan Police wrote in complaining too, because there was a cliffhanger ending where a policeman took off his face and was revealed to be an automaton, a terrifying plastic parody of the human form, murdering everyone in sight. And of course, it's the height of your responsibility to work into a piece of entertainment the hidden message that you can't trust the police. That would be appalling. And show that to children around the country, they come away thinking the police are evil. Especially when you watch episode 3 and see how the Autons are dealt with by Captain Yates at the end of that episode. Because any child watching that would come away with the idea that the best thing you can do if you see a police officer is ram them with your car. Mary Whitehouse. Obviously, that would be irresponsible. But I have to disagree with Mary Whitehouse. You can't shield children from things like that. You can't shield them from the scary, uncomfortable things in life. It's a part of growing up. It's a part of your experience. You can get to the end of a television program. You can switch it off. You can think to yourself, my God, that is the most devastating, despicable, appalling thing I've ever seen on screen. But you know, I'm still feeling. It's an important part of my experience, my life. I'm glad I was here to experience this moment. Which begs the question, what's the one show's excuse? I mean, nothing every time. But it carried on. This Doctor Who got scarier and scarier and scarier. Mary Whitehouse wrote me more and more and more. And finally, in 1976, she had her first big victory. There's an episode of The Deadly Assassin, it was, episode 3, that ended with a freeze frame of the Doctor's head being held underwater. A really frightening image that was left in the mind of a child for a whole week. And there she had a victory. The master tape was edited. That footage was lost for years and years and years. And Doctor Who underwent one of his periodic cabinet reshuffles behind the scenes. The team was changed over. And it was ordered from above that the tone lightened. It completely shifted. And that is what led to my next big encounter with the programme. That this is a good, fun-spirited one. This was in 1977. This happened. Now, what popular science fiction phenomenon first came to Britain in 1977? Did anyone tell me? What was that, my friend?
Ooh, Star Wars.
Yeah, one more time. Nice.
Star
and
Wars!
In there. One more.
Star Wars.
That's absolutely right. K-9.
Hey.
I thought you were a fan. had a robot dog. What a novel idea it was. Incredible. I absolutely loved K-9. And but what was fun, how I managed to meet K-9 was they introduced him to the nation's children on an episode of Blue Peter. And it just so happened that that very same year, 1977, I was living with that legend of the screen, John Noakes. Look, there he is there. Now, I mean, it was a wonderful little time. Now, I had been living by St. Bartholomew's. I was there pretty much my whole time at the BBC. But for a few months in 1977, I had to move out because it had become infested by morph. It absolutely it gets in all the pipes. You wouldn't believe the damage you can do to your water pressure. And you think you've finally caught me, it just immediately shifts in another shape, rolls away. So I went up to John in the canteen at TV Central. I went up to him and I said, John, I have to move out for a little while, but I've had a tremendous idea. Why don't you and I live together? Wouldn't that be enormous fun? And he said to me, who are you? And I thought to myself, I'm in. And he was still quite reluctant for quite a while, quite reticent, but I managed to get my own way in the end there after all. What I did, you see, is I cunningly disguised myself as Shep. That's me in the photo, actually. I mean, it was easy. All I had to do was live as a border collie for 5 months. And it was quite hard. I mean, the diet was appalling, and the costume was agonizingly convincing. I mean, it had to be small. You cannot fit a human limb into it. It's amazing I'm still in one piece, to be honest with you. But they introduced Shep to K-9 whilst I was being it. And I thought, I was quite method act by this point. This was month 5 of the experience. I was really into the role, and I thought to myself, how might Shep react to this thing that looked a little bit like a dog, wasn't quite a dog? I think he'd be quite agitated. So they let me off my lead, and the whole nation's children got to watch as Shep ran at K-9, absolutely rammed him, barked, I bit his ears, I started shutting the house down, I headbutted him, I tried to just turn him over on his side completely. It was absolute television gold. And what the children weren't treated to at home, however, and in a way this is the most entertaining spectacle of all, is what the cameras all saw after they finished rolling. Everyone looked round and saw Shep got a bit carried away. They saw Shep grabbing K-9 with his hind legs, standing on his back legs, holding him above his head, and hurling him into camera 3. Bellowing, I've won! I've won! And I noticed this eerie silence descended all over the studio at TC3, and I looked over the other end, and I saw John, and it's a strange expression he was wearing. He was wearing an expression that, in my experience, you only ever see on the face of a man growing rapidly convinced his beloved dog has been a stranger in disguise for half a year. I tried to backpedal, gave a tentative wolf, but he wasn't having any of it. So that was that. I had to reunite him with Shep in the end. It was fine. He'd been in storage for the duration. It was absolutely fine. And it's not a happy ending, actually, this story. I mean, K-9 never really worked again, sadly. I mean, it was working absolutely fine until I started messing with it, and then it was stuck with him for 3 years. But it does have a happy ending, because John Noakes, actually, as of 2017, I'm pleased to say, his restraining order against me has finally expired. The only downside is, well, I can't take advantage of it, because no matter how many times I ask, his family refuse to tell me what they've done with his ashes. I'm halfway through his tenure, and I haven't even mentioned Tom Baker. It's shocking, isn't it? And this is the problem for me. How on earth do you introduce Tom Baker? This man was Doctor Who. That voice, that face, those eyes, that soul, that scarf. I mean, to give you a bit of shorthand, that I was coming on to do a show about Doctor Who, I came on approximately dressed as him. You know, I mean, all I can really do about it, to talk to you about Tom Baker is give you a genuine quote from him. This is an interview he gave in quite recently. It was in the last few years. And I'm just going to read out to you what he said. This is Tom Baker. This is what he did when he was Doctor Who. I remember a man stopping me in Oxford Street once, looking at me with absolute incredulity. He couldn't believe it. He said, "Tom Baker? A man in his late 30s. I said, "Yes." He said, "Tom Baker?" He said, "Yes." And he looked at me, and his brain catapulted back in time. And he said, "You know, when I was a boy, I was in a home for children. Nobody wanted us. You know, it was terrible. And you made Saturday night good." And I went to say something to him, and I could see him so close to tears that he couldn't speak. He just shook his head as if to say, "Don't go on, don't remind me." And he just did it. Such a common thing, isn't it? But suddenly backed up with expression on his face through his tears. That was a night. It was a night. Just thumbs up, meaning it was great, and thanks. It's incredible, isn't it? Just a gesture. That's what Tom Baker did. And I saw that firsthand as well. I was back in St. Bartholomew's, by this one, the house nearby. Morphine had been scraped clean, it was all fine again. And I went past the playground, I had this ruckus, I hadn't had it for a long time, it was 10 years old from when the Daleks had all been there, playing their little games. And I heard all of these little voices shouting in excitement. In my peripheral vision, I saw this flash of technicolour wool. And I looked past, and Tom Baker was there making a school visit, bringing all the children together, the excitable kids, the loud kids, the sporty kids, the quiet kids, the awkward kids, the lonely kids, everyone just together with their hero. He did this everywhere, all over the country. He opened village fetes, school visits, visited people in hospital. He was a hero to everyone, for everyone. He was connecting with the children in a way I'd never seen anyone do it before, anyone Doctor Who. I realised every generation was going to have their own. At least that's what I realised eventually. At the time, I thought they'd all gone mad. Called the police, had them all arrested. The police made me feel an absolute fool. They said, "What do you mean you shouldn't be at a school? He's from the BBC." And I thought, "Well, fair enough." That was really where Doctor Who lived. It wasn't just on the screen every Saturday night. It lived on in children's minds. It lived in the playground games. Children created whole worlds and galaxies out of their pencil cases. They etched stories into their school desks with a compass instead of doing their work. And it was incredible. It kept children's minds going. From the very beginning, it wasn't just missing episodes that exercised fans' creativity. It was that other staple of the Doctor Who format, the cliffhanger ending. Every time there'd be some peril, the children would go away, playing over their minds for a week. How's he going to get out of that? How's he going to do it? And they would always come back. He always brought them back to see if they'd got it right. And it always worked, even if occasionally the peril that the Doctor found himself in was completely arbitrary and easily solved, completely manufactured, and easily resolved in about 20 seconds later the next week without in any way advancing the plot whatsoever. Oh, my God. I've forgotten the rest of the show. But following an enormous public blunder like this, I might never be allowed back at the Edinburgh Fringe or in the wider Lothian area. Never again! Hang on, wait, I can just check my notes. Sorry. Imagine if you had to wait a whole week for me to just do this. You'd feel so cheated, wouldn't you? I remembered where we are. We reached the 1980s! Hooray! Yes, I the 1980s, a decade when, like so many leading lights of the entertainment industry, Doctor Who did a number of things that would eventually lead to it getting cancelled. I mean, it gives you an eerie premonition of the future as Doctor Who in the 80s. I think it shows you where it got to in recent years as well. I mean, it started out that decade with the most popular actor to date to play the part, finally bowing out, having been custodian for a good innings, and then replaced by the youngest actor in the role to date, and took it to new giddy heights of popularity, bringing new audiences on board all the time. But behind the scenes, there were scheduling blunders, alienating the programme from its audience. There were tonal misjudgments that started fracturing it even further. And before everything seemed rosy for a little while, the dam finally burst following the giddy heights of the programme's 20th anniversary celebration. See, that's why there's no point doing the new series as well, because history just repeats itself. I'd be saying the same things again. 1984 and 2014, the 2 years when the Doctor Who production team dared to ask, what if the new Doctor were completely unlikable? And the audience dared to answer, goodbye. That's a full time. But Tom Baker ended the decade by bowing out. He'd been custodian of this wonderful show for 7 wonderful years. Well, I mean, sort of 3 great years, 2 decent ones, and 2 sort of ones that really split the room. That's therefore inaccurate. But it takes longer to say. And as I said, the show is too long. But he was replaced by that wonderful force of acting talent, Peter Davison, a fresh, new face. I met one, wasn't he? And the first actor ever to wear an edible costume in the role. I mean, it takes all that. Fair play to him. But I mean, Davison brought this breathless quality to the role of the Doctor. It was stunning, really. I mean, people wondered, is it some sense of anxiety at the peril the Doctor faces every week? Is it just boyish enthusiasm at the wonders of the universe? Not true, actually, in either case. I saw it firsthand. The fact of the matter is, Davison was the most notoriously unfit man in the whole of the BBC. And once I saw him try climbing a staircase. He got one up, immediately fainted. People gathered around and said,
no one help him, he has to learn!
But I should have helped him. I don't know what I was going on about, really. But his first year in the role, it brought this sense of vibrancy and youth and new adventure and new directions to Doctor Who. But then suddenly, Tom Baker had ushered into adulthood, and suddenly Doctor Who was aware of this looming anniversary. Davison's second season, Doctor Who, turned 20 years old. And 1983 was a big party anniversary year for everyone. The fans absolutely adored it. Bless you. Bless you. Oh, I was really hoping for 3, so I go, I'm not doing it again. Please, try and be more careful. Get up to 3 next time. It's much, much funnier. But suddenly started looking backwards. It started trying to embrace its past, going up and examining its own continuity. But I thought it was completely the wrong way to go about it. You don't want a show that grows up with its audience, because it was a childhood staple. I think when you grow up from childhood, you want to look back at the things and think, it's still there after all this time. That's what it could have been. I mean, it's like parents and children. You know, mothers stand still so their daughters can look back and see how far... Sorry, that's Barbie. The point still stands. I just thought it was completely wrong. I thought you'd lose the viewers. They get the youngest at your peril if you don't talk about things that are fresh to them. And I thought... I eventually heard in 1983 that Davison had decided to step down because Troughton had spoken and done his worst. And I realised maybe this was my chance to step in, because who was more well-versed in keeping children on board than me? Because, I mean, I was in a fallow period as well. I hadn't been allowed back in the East Tower where the children's department was based ever since the Shep incident. So I was looking for things to do. And I thought to myself, I've done some before me in my time. Why don't I went up to John Nathan Turner, the producer, and I went, why don't, John, I have this wonderful idea. You need to get the kids back on board. I auditioned for the role. I could be your new doctor. What do you say to that, John? And he said to me, who are you? And I said, I'll see you on Monday. So I went away over the weekend and I memorized this passage of Prospero. It was my best work yet. It was incredible. And I went up into his office the Monday morning. I got in front of him and I said to him, which is very unlike me. I was there for 4 days. But I mean, he was absolutely furious. So, you know, I didn't get the gig in the end. They went to another perfectly decent actor, Colin Baker. And he was absolutely, you know, I think he was a terrific actor and a perfectly decent choice. And he actually saw it as a return to the Hartnell era, as far as he was concerned, in terms of how he portrayed the role. And it was a return to the Hartnell era in a way for me as well. Because so incensed with jealousy was I that I took every opportunity to sabotage Doctor Who for the next 6 or so months. Just absolutely, I got the red mist. And I suppose the most damaging thing I did immediately was I crept into the office when they were on the verge of designing his costume. See, they devised this really tasteful outfit for him. It was really wonderful to see it. And I went in the dead of night with all sorts of different crayons, and I thought, well, we'll see about that. So eventually, poor old Colin Baker was introduced to the public looking like this. credit, dear old Colin Baker. He always said the best thing about this costume was he was on the inside looking out. With good humour. But I mean, I didn't realise the damage I was doing. I mean, you have to bear in mind, Doctor Who was being released on home video by this point. It was getting repeated, sold around the country. This was going to have repercussions. It was going to affect future generations, even after he'd gone. I mean, you could show this to a child born in 1991, 5 years after he's left the role, and that child who watched it might grow up one day thinking it's acceptable, age 8, to go to a wedding dressed like this. I mean, it's imagine the damage I was doing. Also, what's he doing with his hands? Why is he so awkward? Why does he look so uncomfortable? I mean, there's a reason he looks a bit uncomfortable in his own skin. But I can't really give you an exact answer because the full formal diagnosis takes about 2 years. So we can't be certain. I will say that if you're a parent of a 7-year-old and your child's favourite thing to read at bedtime is Doctor Who, the Book of Lists, maybe that's something worth looking into. If he's going to sleep, you know, digesting page 148 that takes less than a page to list every single kiss that ever took place in the classic series. The idea that he doesn't really like romance isn't very interesting. As if he, I don't know, struggles to make social connections for some reason.
Worth looking into it, maybe, just an idea.
It's off the top of my head. It was a terrible shame. I mean, that was one thing I did, the most immediately damaging thing, but then I also carried on, and I started sneaking into the scriptwriter's office, Eric Saywood, and he was a very gentle man. He didn't like violence on television, he didn't like cynicism or anything. Yes, there's a couple of sneers of people who do know the opposite is true, but I actually started going tampering with the scripts, and it did enormous damage. I'm going to show you exactly what happened, so I'm going to read you out some samples of the scripts. Now, this is the original script that went down for the rehearsal rooms of Attack of the Cybermen Part 2. It's just a stage direction. The Cybermen quietly escort Commander Lytton to his cell to await interrogation. Now, this is my slightly doctored version that actually went to broadcast. The Cybermen pulp Lytton's hands at 5 o'clock on BBC One. There's a slight difference there, and they just didn't pick it up. I was getting away with murder. I mean, literally, actually. And here's another example. This is the original script from Vengeance on Varos, Part 2. In the course of the struggle, the two guards fall into the acid bath. Doctor, what a senseless and tragic waste of life. And here's my alter version made it to broadcast. In the course of the struggle, the two guards fall into the acid bath. Doctor, you'll forgive me if I don't join you. Now, you see, it's affecting the tone of the script. Now, probably the most egregious example of all is that the original script from The Two Doctors, Part 3, the Doctor evades cannibalistic chef Shockeye, who trips into a ravine and falls to his death. Doctor, what a senseless and tragic waste of life. And here's the broadcast version that I altered. The Doctor creeps up behind Shockeye, forces a net over his head, and suffocates him with cyanide at 5 o'clock on BBC One. He takes some considerable time to die. Doctor, ha-ha, got you, you little shit. Now, in that instance, the dialogue was intercepted, but not the stage direction. But, I mean, you can see the damage I was doing, and it was all the ammunition that now BBC One controller and former second gunman Michael Grade required. I mean, he was absolutely gunning for Doctor Who, an area where, if rumours to be believed, he has quite a degree of proficiency. But he was absolutely appalling. He suspended the programme for 18 months, attempting to cancel it, and he only managed to stop it because in the end, the tabloid press were up in arms, and so were the fans. You know, the fans who Doctor Who had been appealing to all this time, to be fair, it paid off. They were up in arms, and they created a single Doctor in Distress, an appeal that actually appealed to the BBC to actually bring the show back. And I'm not going to play it today for reasons of copyright and taste, but I shouldn't be rude about it. I mean, you know, Doctor in Distress, it raised a lot of money for cancer charities when it was put out, so who am I to, you know, question its value? I'll tell you why. I'm someone who's listened to it. It's appalling. It's worse than torture. But eventually, it came back, and I felt terrible. I the worst thing was, I was doing it out of boredom. I had nothing to do. I mean, Doctor Who and I were being treated just the same way, really. I hadn't been able to make a programme on the BBC for years. Everything kept falling through. No one could find anything for me to do. I was starting to feel less and less relevant. You can deal with Mary Whitehouse trying to take you down, but what you really can't stand is the indifference of the institution trying to take you down. And poor old Colin Baker bore the brunt of it in the end, because they allowed him back after the suspension, 18 months. He did one season, and within that year, he'd been sacked, unceremoniously dismissed, the poor fellow. And to be fair to Michael Grade, you can absolutely see his arguments, can't you? I mean, if you don't like the direction that a whole television programme is taking, it makes complete sense to just sack one figurehead at the start and expect all the rest will completely change. It's like when Boris Johnson resigned as Prime Minister and suddenly the government became good. I'm not saying Sylvester McCoy is the Liz Truss of Doctor Who. I mean, there is is some common ground. I mean, let's be fair, but now, their critics would both argue they were better suited to more comedic roles. That they have in common. And also, and their defenders would also argue that they're actually doing very interesting, worthwhile things in their role, but they were already undermined by a bureaucracy that had decided it already wanted them to fail. The difference is, in McCoy's case, that's actually true. I mean, say what you like about McCoy, at least his performance as the Doctor wasn't so bad the Bank of England had to step in. I suppose, actually, if we continue this analogy, it means Rishi Sunak, that Paul McGann is sort of Rishi Sunak, isn't he? Yes, better, but still really no thank you. I think he was wonderful in the role. He was a genuine eccentric, was McCoy. That's what I really liked about him. I mean, he was a genuine... He started his career, I think, banging nails up his own nose and putting ferrets down his trousers. I mean, he was delighted when the Ken Campbell Roadshow came along, gave him the chance to monetize the lifestyle. But he was a genuine eccentric. But as far as the BBC were concerned, Doctor Who was out of time. The TARDIS had run out of time petrol. I never really explained how it was. It was terrible. The poor fellow, they'd already decided it had had its day. And he said to me, I remember I bumped into old Sylvie, he was unicycling down the corridor. And he said to me, well, you know, it's not so bad. I mean, Troughton always said, only stay for 3 years. It was terrible. I told him the truth of why Troughton was always saying that. He had a complete breakdown. He started growing his hair unkempt, smearing bird poo all over himself. He was delighted when The Hobbit came along, gave him the chance to monetize the lifestyle. The poor old McCoy, it was terrible for him. But then that was it. Doctor Who was gone. And I felt this strange... I felt strangely bereft. I think the whole country did in somewhere. I would walk past in the late 80s, the early 90s. I'd walk past St. Bartholomew's, and the children weren't playing Daleks anymore. They weren't running around with Tommy. They were playing something less worthwhile. Sport or something. One morning I walked past, amongst all the cacophony of people kicking footballs and shouting at each other, I heard this one little voice in the corner. Exterminate, exterminate, I am a Dalek, I am a... I looked over and I realised, he might not be bringing all the children together anymore in the same way, but he still has its place for people, the shy children, the awkward children, the children who aged 8 have absolutely no idea how to dress for a wedding. I mean, a boy born in 1991 could still find a videotape in his uncle's house just a couple of days after his funeral, and could get absolutely hooked. His imagination could be lit up. He'd be so inspired by the scripts he'd start writing, so inspired by the actors that he'd want to perform himself, so inspired by the radiophonic workshop he'd start making music of his own, so inspired by the whole programme that he'd learned to knit so he could make himself a scarf. That's what he did. And even though he might not have had many friends of his own to play with, it didn't seem to matter. He never knew what the secret was to finding friends of your own, but he was playing another game instead, a game across time. The ghost of all the children who left their footprints on the playground before him. And carving whole worlds into his desk. Creating whole new adventures in his playground games and his pencil case. That's what Doctor Who did. It gave him a North Star, a map that showed him where he was and where he wanted to be. Even into his adulthood, in dark days, it's still the one thing that can quieten down the voice in his head that's always there telling him there's something wrong with him. And he can watch that program, and it gives him a lens to look at his whole life through, and suddenly remember, oh, this is me. That's what Doctor Who can do. That's what television can do. Even when Doctor Who is like that, the most insignificant, the silliest, most forgotten TV program, a joke, a punchline, a byword for bad television. And even then, even in that sorry state, it can light up a child's imagination. It can create ripples. It takes the course of life. It begs the question, what's the one show? Oh, nothing. But that's what Doctor Who did. The sad thing about it is, when I feel for the people who weren't around to see what happened next. I'll just let it fade away. It's better. It's good work. I did well. Spent ages there making that. You feel for the people who weren't around to see what it became. William Hartnell, Patrick Troughton, John Pertwee, John Nathan Turner. All of them had gone before it came back. They didn't get to see what happened next. And there's one thing I know. When you're making television, and they're treated with indifference, and your programmes are reviled and joked about and wiped and destroyed, you wonder, was it all worth it? What was it all for? And when you're a fan, you wonder that as well. You think, should I really grow up? Maybe I should just let it all go.
When I became a man, I put away childish things. But you know, thank goodness for him that not everyone did. There were some people who always knew exactly what it meant, exactly why it mattered. And by now, these people had started to grow up. Doctor Who might not always have grown up with them, but they'd grown up themselves, and they were working in the industry, and they kept what it felt like with them. And they knew what could be special for them could be special all over again. And this was the next century, the 21st century. And by now, there were children all over Britain who didn't realize they needed a doctor. Maybe. I mean, it's not, we don't know. I have to put the disclaimer in case it turns out that I'm not an irresistible agent. I'm sorry if I was. You never know. It seems very likely. I mean, you've seen The Last Hour. Went into people after someone had told me for the first time they thought I might be, and everyone said, "Oh, so you have thought about it, right?" Unbelievable. But there was a gap in the schedule. The TV landscape of the noughties, it was a barren place. There was a gap in the schedule, especially for families at the weekend. We needed something to make Saturday night good. They knew what was needed. I knew what was needed as well. In a manner entirely befitting, a show all about time travel. We'd come full circle. Everyone knew what was needed. I did as well. It was time for an icon to return. And so join me in my little time machine again as we head back to March 2005. Amarillo is number one in the charts. The UK is enjoying its final full year in which the one show doesn't exist. And who should be outside Television Centre in the car park but me, a pitch document clutched in my hand for Clockman the Wizard 2000. I went up to the guard at the door. He said to me, "Who are you?" I'd learned my lesson by then. I shoved him to the ground. I sprinted past him. I went into the lift. I hurtled up to floor 6. I ran into the controller of BBC One's office, Lorraine Hegarty, her name was. I looked her in the eyes. I held the document above my head, and I said to her, this is a one-off for the Edinburgh Fringe, but there will be other dates happening around the country in the run-up to the anniversary in November. Please keep up on X and on any kind of social media that you're still on, and tell your friends if you think they'd enjoy it. And there's one in London at some point, TBC, Manchester on the 21st of November, Bath on the 11th of September. That's the next one along. Aberystwyth, probably one somewhere else, but you know, I need someone to reply to an email. But look, tell all your friends, thank you so much for having me. Most of you have paid to get in. I think some of you probably haven't. If you want to give £5 or any multiple of it, because I can do that, you can. Thank you very much. Keep supporting live comedy. Enjoy the anniversary in November. Have a wonderful rest of the day.